When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast, and now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right, you're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas, that's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 10 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, once again, we had a UFC-free weekend this past weekend, not for the first time this month, and once again, coming up this Saturday, we have a very low-profile UFC fight night. Listeners have chimed in to say this is not out of the ordinary for the UFC in the fall, particularly in the month of October. I have not gone back to do the necessary research to figure out whether or not that is true. But man, I feel like this whole month just kind of underscores to me the boom and bust nature of the UFC calendar for the fan, for the UFC viewer. Of course, there is no real boom and bust for the UFC anymore. It's all kind of a boom. Just one long, never-ending boom, as Endeavor bigwigs have explained to investors during their recent meetings. They have, quote, taken the lumpiness out of the business. It's all just one ATM spitting out cash for the UFC at this point. So if we get one of these Octobers, where frankly, it kind of feels like they just threw their hands up in the air, and we're like, you know, whatever. That affects us as viewers, but doesn't necessarily affect the bottom line of the UFC.
Yeah, and maybe you can make the argument doesn't really affect ESPN that much, which relies on the UFC as sort of programming, like staple programming on the weekends. But when we're into October and ESPN Plus, I don't know if you've noticed, and I feel like you probably have, has quite a bit of college football content on there every single Saturday now. Maybe they don't really feel the loss of the UFC. It's only the fans who have been in this sort of drug dealer-ish from an 80s after-school special type relationship with the UFC, where they gave you a free one here or there, they got you used to it, now you're hooked, then they take it away, and now you're begging for the opportunity to spend $80 on UFC 280 later this month.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like they're opting for an absence makes the heart grow fonder.
And I think that works. I think that might actually work.
Yeah, as a sort of a PR move for the upcoming UFC 280. And you're right to say that right now it's very, very crowded professional sports calendar out there. You got Major League Baseball playoffs are underway. College football is really getting into the meat of the season. The NFL is just kind of ramping up into like its regular season. Basketball players are punching each other at practice. So there's a lot of stuff to compete with out there. So you're right. Maybe this is by design. Maybe the UFC figures, you know what? We're going to save some bullets in the gun here during this very, very busy sports time of the year. And, you know, we will fire our best shots when we feel like we have the opportunity to make the biggest sales. I don't know.
I mean, I feel like it's already working on people to get them excited for any kind of UFC content and get them so that they can't wait to fork over their money for an actual big time pay-per-view that they care about.
Yeah. Speaking of forking over your money, you know, we launched the CME's new merch site a week ago. I oftentimes get the MMA juggernaut that is the UFC confused with the MMA podcasting juggernaut that
both
is the
multi-billion
CMA.
Dollar businesses. Yeah,
that's right. That's correct. Both run ruthlessly from the top by multi-hundred millionaires who rule with an iron fist. We launched the new CME merch shop a week ago, and frankly, Shit is flying off the shelves. We are fulfilling orders in Australia and New Zealand, Norway, the fictional country of Ireland, Canada, all over the United States of America. If you haven't yet gone over to our website, comainevent.com, and clicked the link at the top of the screen that says shop, that'll get you over there to the new merch site where we got Are You Fucking Kidding Me shirts for sale. We got CME logo shirts and hats for sale. We got Dundasso hoodies and t-shirts for sale. And you know what? You know what's been the biggest seller? And we should probably not be surprised by this. But the biggest seller so far, available in three or four colors, I might add, the Bobby Knuckles t-shirts that obviously are celebrating the nickname for Robert Whittaker that this podcast helped popularize. And we've got a clever design out there that kind of apes the old Black Flag logo, which everyone loves so much. The Bobby Knux t-shirts, you can barely keep them in stock. People are just buying them like crazy. Some people are buying like the same shirt in two or three different colors.
Yeah, which I understand. I'm a middle-aged dad. I understand how you get something you like. You want to have one for every day of the week. Why should I ever wear any other pair of pants other than this pair of jeans I bought once 12 years ago and liked? I get it. I just got to say, we've tried a couple different ways to reach out to Robert Whittaker to let him know that half of the profits from these t-shirts, the way we see it, belong to him. All you got to do is get in touch with the podcast. Bobby, the money's just sitting there, my man. Just all you got to do is speak up and be like, hey, I would like my money now. Don't even have to do anything for it.
Yeah.
We're serious about this.
He should speak up soon because the person in charge of making sure that we hang on to that money is you. So he better get in touch with us in a couple weeks or all that money is going to be spent during happy hour down at Katie O'Keefe's.
Or I come back from the racetrack with bad news about my system.
Yeah. Thought I was going to double up the Bobby Knux take. Turns out it all ran away from me on the ponies.
Maybe I'll do what you have done recently when some of your bets go bad is to demand the logic behind the bets still fundamentally sound.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I still feel that way about my 3-game college football parlay, which fell apart over the weekend. I was up in Great Falls. Now, we talked about this on the Power Hour over on the Patreon page on Friday. I did a 3-game college football parlay this weekend because there was no UFC. My number one pick, the can't miss pick, the pick where I was like, oh, you got to go for this, Nevada over Colorado State, because last week, Colorado State was ranked as the worst college football team in America by the folks over at our former employer, The Athletic. I should have known they were trying to fuck us again. I get home from the event I had to go to, get back to my hotel room on Friday night in Great Falls, Montana, turned on FS1, a blast from the past to find that on my cable dial, to check this game out. Colorado State was already up 14-0, and it didn't get no better for the Wolfpack of Nevada Reno, who lost, giving Colorado State the worst team in the college football landscape, in the nation, their first win of the year, Ben Folks. I feel like Colorado State might have listened to the podcast and maybe used it as bulletin board material.
Do you think the coach printed out some of the comments from the podcast, put them up there in the locker room, and like, listen to what they're saying about you on the CME? You going to let them talk that way about you to an audience of millions?
Yeah. Yeah, they probably did. And then I was screwed from there. Remember, we're partnering on the shop, the new merch shop, with our guys at Superconductor, a brand and design studio. You've seen their work with the CME for a long time now. Our longtime collaborator, Johnny Ashcroft, is responsible for all of the wonderful designs we've got up there right now. Superconductor builds brand worlds, dreams up product packaging, conjures content, and illustrates illustration, and much more. If you have any design needs, we recommend you hit up our guys at Superconductor over at studiosuperconductor.com or on Instagram at Studio Superconductor. As you know by now, you're listening to the Co-Main Event podcast proper. Go on over and support us on Patreon if you would. We got a patronage tier over there for every budget. You can join at the $1, $5, $10, or $20 level, which should appeal to just about everyone. Get access to up to 3 additional podcasts per week, the live chat where you can communicate directly with us, the Doing the Damn Thing podcast, where we talk about things outside the MMA world, and of course the Friday Power Hour, which is an additional hour of curated MMA talk every single week. And maybe most importantly, you get access to the Co-Main Event podcast's official Discord, the best MMA community on the internet, where people are constantly over there talking about everything MMA, life, all kinds of stuff happening over at the CME Discord. So you want to be part of that. Go over to patreon.com/co-main event and join the team to help us out. We got new music this week. New music alert from our guy, Dennis Pham. A self-described, quote, day one co-maniac from San Diego that says, in his own words, writes a song every few years. He's got a new single out. It's called The Fire, and it is available on Spotify and Apple Music and all the other major music streaming platforms. You're going to hear it between rounds today. So if you like what you hear, go out and try to find The Fire and buy it by our guy, Dennis Pham. We got three rounds as usual this week in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number one, steroid accusations continue to mount around Conor McGregor in the absence of any apparent testing. Could somebody please drug test this man? And in round number two, at 42 years old and more than 10 years away from the kickboxing ring, Alistair Overeem can still do the damn thing. Or at least he can still do some damn things. And in round number three, this garbage-ass UFC fight night. All that plus are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff. But first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
First piece of listener mail this week comes from our guy Pissed Off Lawyer over on Twitter. You can follow him at Pissed Off Lawyer. He is a good follow. He writes, Frankie Edgar just booked what is expected to be his retirement fight against Chris Gutierrez at the upcoming MSG card for entirely unrelated reasons. That certainly have nothing to do with the likely violent outcome of this fight. Do you guys have any tips for the co-maniacs for dealing with feelings of extreme sadness in the middle of a UFC pay-per-view? Now, Ben, see, it might be advantageous that we are all building a wall around our hearts in advance of seeing Anderson Silva box Jake Paul, because perhaps that will also come in handy when Frankie Edgar makes the walk in the UFC for his final time to go out there and fight Chris Gutierrez at UFC 281 on November the 12th.
I just feel like it would have been possible to make a less cannibalizing its parts kind of fight for Frankie Edgar on his way out the door. It would have been possible to find a peer, another fighter with a name, and maybe you worry that, hey, you find him somebody else like a Dominic Cruz or somebody like that who is saying to himself, I'm trying to move up the ranks. I'm not trying to just be out here just fighting other known guys just for your entertainment one Saturday night. Fair. Maybe that is an obstacle, getting somebody to do a fight like this if they don't see what it does for them in their career and if they're not looking to get out the game the way Frankie Edgar is. But it also seems like we're going to want to do a whole lot of, hey, let's honor old man Edgar, the career he's had, the incredible career he's had, the kind of improbable run he had to the lightweight title despite never actually being a natural lightweight. And then we're going to throw him out there and be like, and now we're to show you how much we love and respect you, we're going to say goodbye by trying to get your ass kicked by somebody 10 years younger than you.
Yeah.
And that's just, I don't know why we do that. Why we do that, Chad?
Oh, I think it's because we're sick as a subculture. If anybody deserves a more graceful exit from the UFC, whether you like him or dislike him or cheered for him or not during his time on top or throughout his long UFC career, Frankie Edgar has earned, in my opinion, a graceful exit from this sport if that's what he wants to do. And frankly, I mean, I know what we're trying to do. Everybody knows what we're trying to do. This is not a new trick. It's the oldest trick there is to try to get a young up-and-coming fighter a meaningful win against an old dog who was a former champion who is now on his way down and out of the sport. But really, we're going to do this to Frankie Edgar? We're going to book him against a 31-year-old man in Chris Gutierrez who lost in the final of the Ultimate Fighter heavy hitters back in 2018, but has since gone unbeaten in the UFC, currently in the midst of a seven fight, I think, unbeaten streak. He is 6-0-1, had the one draw against Cody Durden back in August of 2020, but in all other respects has been spotless in his UFC career. We're going to have him fight that guy? Really? Because that seems pretty transparent in terms of what we're trying to do with this fight booking.
Yeah. And I guess I understand that there's like a matchmaking formula with stuff like this where we're like, hey, the same way we're trying to do Nate Diaz against Khamzat Chimaev, if we're losing one guy, we need to make sure that it props up a future guy. That's how we keep this whole machine running. But I also feel like the flip side of the UFC being such a well-promoted brand at this point that it almost doesn't matter who they put up there. That as soon as they sign somebody, and even if they don't sign somebody, as soon as they put somebody on the Dana White's Contender Series, they can convince a whole section of MMA fans that this person matters now when they wouldn't have mattered last week, or they wouldn't have mattered 3 months ago when they were fighting in Titan or whatever, but now they matter because they're in the UFC. The flip side of that power should be that you don't necessarily have to do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And that you could do a fight where we're just like, hey, we actually do like and respect this guy, and we're not clearly trying to get his ass beat as we say goodbye to him. Like, we're going to give him, we're not going to give him a gimme or anything, but we'll give him, you know, somebody who is a peer around the same area as him. And therefore, like, it doesn't look like we had one thing in mind when we booked this.
Yeah. Not to belabor the point, but I just want to say out loud before I forget that it is amazing the sheer time that Frankie Edgar has spent in the UFC constantly fighting top dudes.
Yeah.
If you look at Frankie Edgar's record, you gotta look real hard and scroll down an awful long way to find fights where he was not fighting top dudes. I mean, you look at his fight against Pedro Munhoz in August of 2020. I don't know how you want to consider Pedro Munhoz. I consider him to be a real tough son of a bitch and like a tough out for anybody. But aside from that, man, Frankie Edgar is out here fighting championship level dudes for the most part. He's fighting Corey Sandhagen at 40 years old, Marlon Vera, Max Holloway, Brian Ortega, Cub Swanson, Yair Rodriguez, Jose Aldo, Uriah Faber, BJ Penn, fought Chucky Olives back in 2013 and beat him, by the way.
Beat Chucky Olives in a fight of the night.
Beat him at UFC 162. Had the fights with Gray Maynard. Had the fights with Benson Henderson. Had the fights with BJ Penn. In December of 2009, he fought Matt Veitch. And other than that, man, it's Gray Maynard and Hermes Franca and Sean Sherk and BJ Penn. Just like every fight you look at, Frankie Edgar is out there fighting the toughest guys that the UFC could find. I mean, sometimes up a weight class or two from where he finished.
Yeah.
And he's beaten many of them, beating lots of them, becoming the champion. It's unreal almost. I don't want to come off as a huge Frankie Edgar homer. I do like the guy, but at the same time, I don't know how you look at that record and you don't think like this is a guy who has earned to phase out of the sport any damn way he wants. And maybe this is what he wants as far as we know.
Yeah, maybe. But you are right to point out that not only has he been doing it at a high level for so long, but fighting at lightweight only because that was the lowest weight class the UFC offered. Not because that was where his body would work the best or like where he was had the chance to be the most successful, as we've seen later on in his career. But also, it's like, even if you go and you look and be like, okay, he had six fights on the regional circuit and just fighting in like New Jersey promotions, like Reality Fighting. Even there, Jed, his last fight before he jumped to the UFC was against Jim fucking Miller.
Yeah.
So
tough dudes.
Yeah.
You know how we always say, like, if you are the guy who gets the phone call to come fight Bo Nickel, or in Bellator, you're the guy who gets the phone call to maybe come fight Aaron Pico. Like, yeah, that probably doesn't, I don't know how that makes you feel, but it's probably not a sign that the UFC wants to get in the Jamie Pickett business or whoever Bo Nickel is about to fight. I wonder how you feel if you're Chris Gutierrez and you get the call to come fight Frankie Edgar. Like, obviously it's a business. You got to go out there and win the fights. You probably see this as a big opportunity for yourself. But at the same time, you're like, man, you want me to come in and fight this legendary 40-year-old man so I can beat him and like steal his shine a little bit. Maybe this is part of what makes me not a professional fighter, this and all of the athletic and toughness requirements. But like, I would feel bad about that. I would be like, oh man, you want me to do what to who? Maybe Chris Gutierrez thinks that, you know, I will go out there and I will honor this warrior by beating the shit out of him and like taking everything that he has earned. Like, maybe that's how we honor each other in this sport. I don't know.
I hope that this becomes your catchphrase, kind of like Kamaru Usman had take what from who. You can have an incredulous do what to who?
Yeah.
Where you seem horrified by man's inhumanity to man. I like that.
Yeah. We got a very long email from Chris Kirk this week about fighters testing positive for PEDs, Bobby Green and Conor Benn specifically. He says, I'm not going to read the whole thing, I don't think, because it is very long. He says, as a sports scientist who spends part of my working week supporting pro athletes and fighters, this has been another weekend of seeing bad takes regarding PEDs in combat sports. This is not really a question, but more of a statement of the most likely scenarios regarding Conor Benn and Bobby Green. Now, I'm going to skip down to the Bobby Green part, because that's the part that affects us most acutely here in mixed martial arts. Now, Bobby Green, who we all know at this point, has received a 6-month suspension from USADA for testing positive for an anabolic steroid that he says came from a supplement that he took, that he bought at Walmart, by the way. Now, Bobby Green, writes Chris Kirk, you can either believe that A, Bobby Green and his camp actually think that off-the-shelf supplements are safe from contamination and also do not know how to use Google to find out what is and isn't banned. This would make them absolute rank amateurs who do not perform the most basic anti-doping due diligence required for working with or being a professional athlete. Or B, Bobby Green has been caught red-handed and knows he can take advantage of USADA using an extremely watered-down version of the WADA anti-doping rules that allow fighters to use the age-old excuse of supplement contamination. Then he says, parenthetically, which, by the way, is an excuse that cannot be used under the actual WADA rules. We'd like to pretend that WADA and USADA make combat sports clean, but the V in WADA stands for voluntary, and USADA have changed their rules in such a way that fighters are rarely given more than a small slap on the wrist. So which of the Bobby Green options does the CME think is more likely? Love you both equally, Chris Kirk. Now, as an addendum to this, let me just say, Bobby Green has accepted this suspension, and because I believe it is retroactive to when he tested positive, his 6-month suspension, I believe, actually lapses next month, so he will be able to come back and compete again starting in November.
Okay. And for his suspension was for saying that he used an over-the-counter supplement that contained DHEA, right? And so I understand the point that Chris Kirk is trying to make here about how WADA doesn't even allow you to make the case, doesn't even allow you to use as any sort of defense, hey, it was a contaminated supplement. I actually don't hate the idea that you can at least make the case, and if you can prove it, if you can actually show us, here's the supplement I bought, here's the batch number it was from, here's where I got it from, here's, like, if you can show the receipts, basically, and if they can go and test it and be like, this doesn't say on the label that it has this in it, but we got something from the same batch and we tested it on our own, an unopened container, and found that it does, in fact, have that. Like, I'm not saying it should get you off, like, it should get you no punishment, but I don't hate the idea that that could get you a somewhat lighter punishment if you could prove that, like, okay, I fucked up, but I did it on accident. I didn't willingly, knowingly try to cheat. Because I do think that that can absolutely happen, especially, I mean, as much as we can joke about how, yeah, you're a pro fighter under a stringent anti-doping program, you probably shouldn't be going to Walmart to get your supplements. Yet, at the same time, we also frequently talk about how fighters don't make a ton of money. So it's not like they all have their own teams of nutritionists and people responsible for taking care of this shit. So I don't hate that that's at least an option. And yet at the same time, like, you know, he makes a similar point here in this email, the part that you didn't read where he was talking about Conor Benn and how, you know, the A sample comes up positive. And if you don't ask for them to immediately test the B sample, it's because you know.
Yeah.
It's because you know what was in that A sample and you know that it's probably in the B sample too. And you know that they got you. Yeah. And that one, I mean, sure, we're pointing out the V in VADA stands for voluntary, but the fight didn't happen as a result of that. I mean, they tried. Eddie Hearn really tried to be like, hey, sure, whatever. He failed a VADA test. He didn't fail any kind of like actual regulatory test that matters. We should be able to still do this fight, right? And they were like, no, bro. No, you're not going to talk your way out of this one. And I get all the points that we're bringing up and you're making here. And sure, like it's entirely possible if you want to tell me Bobby Green was taking something and then when he got caught, had a scapegoat ready to blame it on the supplement or everything. But I also feel like you got to understand the anti-doping landscape that we are now is still better than where we were. Yeah. Like, if you want to sit here and be like, USADA is not perfect, hey, man, absolutely. I feel like there's a real lack of transparency with USADA that, like, has gotten worse since this. Before they signed that contract with the UFC, you could get a USADA person on the phone and get them to talk to you and tell you their system really easily. And then increasingly, with every year that passed after they signed that deal with the UFC, that has changed. And that's not a great sign. There's a lot of our questions I'm sure we'll get into about who's being tested, how often, and who's not. So, like, there's a lot of stuff wrong with the USADA thing. But still, I think a lot of people maybe who come into the sport relatively newer don't really realize how wide open it used to be.
Yeah.
And how not only was it people just knew, okay, I'm going to be tested on fight week by the commission and that's it. I don't have to worry about any other testing. So like the system was way easier to beat, but it was also way more bullshit in that we were kidding ourselves that there was actual drug testing going on. And yeah. And there kind of wasn't. It was especially so that if you had any sort of money to put into it and sophistication, or anybody on your team who had the sophistication, it was super easy to beat. And so it was just giving more of an advantage to the already famous and wealthier fighters.
Yeah. I was much more of a hardline anti-doping guy in the past than I am today.
Me too.
And I don't know if you could have felt any different way if you were here living through and witnessing the TRT era, because it was just so ludicrous in some ways what was going on. And, you know, having listened to Alistair Overeem, who we'll talk about later in the show, use the same excuse that Ben Johnson used when he tested positive, I think in the like 1980 or 1984 Summer Olympics, where he said, my doctor injected me without telling me that this steroid. And at the time I thought that was ludicrous and all this other stuff. The more that I have reported on and talked to people in the anti-doping world, I have become less of a hardliner about it. And I certainly think now that the anti-doping industry is not perfect. I think that there are tons of flaws in it. I think that it is just like everything else in our culture, harder on lesser known, poorer athletes than it is on athletes that have the means to defend themselves, athletes that are better recognized. And I'll sit here and tell you right now, I don't know that the UFC should strictly adhere to the WADA code. I just don't know if they should. Like, I don't know if MMA fighters should be subject to the same banned substances list as track stars and chess players, golfers. I don't know. I don't know if it's a one size fits all kind of thing. Like, if I trusted the UFC a little more, I would say it would be good for the UFC to work with USADA to come up with their own banned substances list that is more tailored toward MMA fighters. And I don't know. At this point, if you go down the list of what's banned and what's not, like what is truly harmful for an MMA fighter to take and what might actually just be helpful for an MMA fighter to take if you're going to compete in this very grueling sport. Like, obviously, there should be some stuff that they don't take, but there's other things that maybe are just purely beneficial to them and not necessarily a danger to their opponent or any of these other things. So I don't know that I am a strict adherent to the WADA principles at this point, which I think are as fallible as a lot of other people in this industry making rules and stuff like that. Now, all that said, if you want to look at Bobby Green and say, here's a 36-year-old man who has recently gone through a bit of a renaissance at the top of the MMA game and had some success and was keeping it going maybe longer than some other people would when they would be beyond their athletic prime, and say, here's a guy who's probably ripe for a positive drug test, I'm not going to argue with you about that. Like, and Bobby Green may well have been cutting some corners and doing some things, But there are also contaminated supplements. They do exist. Yeah. The supplement industry, unfortunately, is almost completely unregulated by the government. Is it stupid for Bobby Green to get his supplements at a 24-hour Walmart with a self-checkout? Yeah, probably is. The UFC and USADA produces a list of like gold standard supplements that they say won't make you test positive. And if you're a UFC fighter and you want to take supplements, you should probably take supplements on that are on that list. But again, I don't know anything about the financial situation here or how much those supplements cost or what Bobby Green is doing or paying for. And like if this 36-year-old man took some steroids illegally, well, he got caught and he's going to serve his time and he'll be back like when that time is over. And that's the most I can really say about it at this point, because I'm a lot more conflicted about the system now than I was maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, those chess players ought to be able to take DHEA, though, if they want it.
I mean, if you're a chess player, I think you should be able to take all the hardcore 1970s bodybuilding steroids that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Get fucking whacked out on stanozolol if you're a fucking professional chess player. Be sitting over there looking like Bill Kazmaier. Queen yeah. pawn to queen pawn four, says 300-pound powerlifting ass chess champion. Go for it, man.
Just sitting down, you can't even button the top button of your dress shirt and being like, all right, now I'm going to run the London opening on your ass. And what are you going to do about it, you pencil neck geek?
Mm-hmm. I mean, chess would probably be popular, more popular.
Mm-hmm. If they were jacked.
Yeah, jacked dudes and in tank tops.
I don't know. The scandal about whether the guy is using anal beads to cheat has actually, I think, helped their visibility a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. Should an MMA fighter be subject to the same rules? Should an MMA fighter be able to have the anal beads?
100%. If you're an MMA fighter, here's a hill I'm going to die on. If you're an MMA fighter and you're willing to get some sort of instruction from your corner throughout the fight via anal beads, you should 100% be allowed to do that. The only thing is, you should have to tell us you're doing it. We should know that you're doing it and be like, okay, bro. But also, like, hey, that's the way you tell us that you want to win, that you really want it, you know?
Yeah. No, you should have to, John Anik should have to say it on the broadcast. He's like, here is an interesting welterweight fight. Xavier Silva has opted for the anal beads tonight, so he'll be using those out there in the cage.
I agree. I mean, if your coach is over there telling you, you know, let's throw a two and then try for a takedown, the other guy can hear it. But if he's communicating with you via vibrating anal beads, you know what? He doesn't know what's coming.
That's right. All right, we got some more questions here. I'm going to skip a couple of them because we ran a little long here talking about the anal beads. But this one comes to us from Walton Goggins, who I believe is a noted character actor. He writes, I hesitate to even bring it up, but Greg Hardy won his boxing debut over the weekend. Why did I have to read about this on the MMA news sites I frequent? Why am I writing you to ask about it?
It's gonna be my question.
Why on earth are any of us still talking about Greg Hardy? Are we really that sick? He writes, did you see the poor son of a bitch that they brought in to fight Greg Hardy in a boxing match?
No, I did not, because I was content to ignore it. I was content to say, okay, Greg Hardy is off doing another sport. He's off in boxing. We don't ever need to talk about him again. Well, we don't ever need to hear about him again. I was going to let him go. Walton Goggins, who is, in fact, a very notable character actor. I mean, you'd recognize him just from The Hateful Eight alone, you know.
Yeah.
But I can appreciate that for him. Maybe this feels like I couldn't avoid it, therefore I'm going to make sure no one else can avoid it. But for me, I was really content to be like, all right, I see your headlines about something about Greg Hardy boxing. I'm sticking with our conclusion back then, which was that now we don't need to care. Don't need to care at all. Don't even need to talk about it.
In theory, I agree with you. And in principle.
Oh, here we go.
If you want to see some Kareem Abdul-Jabbar against Bruce Lee in Game of Death ass shit, do yourself a favor and go just watch a second of Greg Hardy's boxing match against this terrified, physically overmatched, comparatively tiny man that he knocked out in the second round. Because let's just say the size difference is striking. No mm-hmm. pun intended.
Okay. I mean, I believe that. And I appreciate Baby Billy Freeman from the Righteous Gemstones writing in to talk to us about it. I am exercising my right to not give a shit about anything Greg Hardy does anymore.
I support that.
Not going to watch it. Not going to even talk about it after I finish this sentence.
You should see the guy they brought in for him to knock out. Okay, moving on. From Dangerous Doug, he wrote, "Fellas, if I may, Paul Craig versus Johnny Walker. Total Weirdsmobile fight, right?" Yeah. Total Weirdsmobile fight. Yes.
I mean, and yet, will you not be entertained?
Oh, absolutely. I love a Weirdsmobile fight. Anybody who's listened to this podcast before knows that Weirdsmobile fights is some of my favorite stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to look at the records and be like, are we sure we haven't done this a couple times already? Because it feels like maybe we would have gotten around to it, you know? But I don't know. You know, I'm curious about what's going on with Paul Craig these days, because he had a nice little win streak going there. Maybe you could even call it an improbable win streak going there for a little while. And then when I watched him against the Secret of the Ooze, Volkan Ozdemir, in that fight night event in London over the summer, and it was some real let's do MMA jiu-jitsu like it's still 2001 and I'm just pulling guard and hoping you'll follow me down there kind of shit. And it's like, I don't know if that's really going to work anymore. If you're going to be the jiu-jitsu specialist guy who wins a bunch of fights, even in a Hail Mary fashion off your back, stuff like that, there's got to be a little something else that you got, little something else that you can do there. Especially against a Weirdsmobile like Johnny Walker, who, you know, he can come in and do some wild ass stuff at times.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see what his strategy is for this fight.
Here's an idea right here. We got this mail from Dr. Sarah Sitarides. She's a character in Seinfeld, whoever it
is. Okay.
She just writes, "Can you tickle in MMA?"
Huh. You know what? I feel like even if you made a rule against tickling, it's so subjective.
Yeah.
Because what are you going to say to like the referee, he's tickling me? And then I'm going to be like, no, I'm not. And you'll be, well, why am I laughing? And be like, that's your problem, bro.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you could say a guy punches you really hard in the face. You could be like, I tickled. He tickled me when he did that. I demand that he loses a point. I can't off the top of my head think of a rule in mixed martial arts that would prohibit tickling. Unless you get into some small joint manipulation at some point.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're just like putting the fingers in the armpit and just a little something something, that's not, there's no joint manipulation at work there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I bet you could get away with it if only because who is going to complain to the ref? Who's going to be like, he's tickling me? Make him stop. Yeah. Herb, he's tickling me. You know, even if you think, like, it would really be a mind fuck. Honestly, it might open up, like, the opportunity to then throw some elbows and punches, because if you start tickling the guy and he's going to be like, wait, is this motherfucker tickling me? Oh, hell no. Yeah. And then while he is confused and just in a state of total bafflement, you elbow him right in the teeth. Boom.
I mean, all I'm saying is if you are considering tickling as a viable strategy in a high-level MMA fight, man, you go out there and try to tickle Peter Yan. Go ahead. Be my guest. See what happens.
Now see, Peter Yan is the kind of guy who would get punched in the face and then turn the ref and be like, he's trying to tickle me.
Yeah. Just try to tickle that guy. See what happens.
That couldn't be him trying to hurt me with that weak-ass punch. He must be trying to tickle me.
Or as Tank Abbott said, tickle his brain a little bit there.
Oh, Jesus.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's listener mail. Thanks for your questions, comments, and concerns. If you want to air those to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. Go over to the website, comainevent.com. Click the link at the top of the page that says shop, buy a t-shirt, then go back to comainevent.com and click the link in the top right-hand corner that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. As for right now, I'm not trying to blackmail you into buying a shirt. If you want to ask a question, you can. You could just do that even if you don't buy a shirt.
But you're going to need some shirts to wear at some point.
You're
going to
be at the website already anyway to ask the question. You might as well buy a Daddest Man on the Planet coffee mug while you're there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Christmas will be here before you know it, and dads are notoriously hard to shop for.
Mm-hmm. Father's Day. You're just sitting around for Father's Day being like, what am I going to get my dad? Oh, that's right. Daddest man on the planet coffee mug from the CME shop. That's how you do it.
These bad boys just came out, so you know he doesn't already have one.
That's right. Damn right he doesn't. Click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast if you want to ask us a question. As for right now, though, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one. Well, Ben, we've been talking for a couple weeks now on our various properties about this revelation from September that the UFC's Conor McGregor apparently hasn't been tested by USADA since the third quarter of 2021, which would make it about a year since they have tested Conor McGregor. USADA itself has issued a statement on the matter. I'm not sure that it clarified much. And from there, these steroid allegations around Conor McGregor, well, let's just say they haven't gone away by any stretch of the imagination. You had Justin Gaethje come out recently and say, quote, it sounds to me like he's off taking steroids right now. He hasn't been drug tested by USADA in quite some time. I'm looking for fair competition. If he's on steroids, then give me steroids and let's go. I'm down with that. My health is my biggest factor. I have never taken a performance-enhancing drug, and I do not want to fight people that are taking performance-enhancing drugs. So Gaethje, casting some stones there, but also hedging his bets a little bit. Just be like, hey, give me some steroids, and we can go. And then you got Daniel Cormier openly speculating that, you know, Justin Gaethje's probably not just saying these things off the top of his head, he's saying for Gaethje to say that so confidently tells me that either him or his team is kind of looking into it. I'm pretty sure Gaethje has an idea of when McGregor was tested last. So I don't know if DC thinks Justin Gaethje and the folks down there in Colorado have acquired the services of a private investigator or something, but I'm pretty sure he's hashtag just saying stuff.
Yeah. And using the same evidence the rest of us are, really, which is the suspicious lack of testing and the old-fashioned eye test.
Yeah, like that's looking like a thick boy. Although Daniel Cormier has some comments about that, too. He says, Conor McGregor is not a tall guy, so if he starts to gain weight, he's going to look a little bigger. He's going to look a little bit more full. And he looks a little more puffy. Now, speaking of guys who are not tall, Daniel Cormier could be the authority on this, of knowing, like, you know, he's been fought at a couple of weight classes. He's had some body transformations, you know, the weight goes up, weight comes down. He's a short guy. He's going to look a little thicker, says DC.
Yeah. I mean, for me, this all really just comes down to, like, I don't think any Conor McGregor fans are going to give a shit. You know, you talk about it and be like, you got guys like Justin Gaethje. First of all, I love him being like, if he's on steroids, give me steroids. As if like that, they should be like, well, okay, Justin, just to even it out, we're sending you a box of steroids.
Yeah, we're going to do a steroid fight. The steroid championship.
Can you be home between 2 and 5 today to sign for the package? They really do need somebody to sign for it there. They won't just leave. They'll leave a note on your door and it's a hassle, man. Better to just be there when our shipment of steroids for you shows up.
Yeah.
But it's a bad look for is the UFC and USADA and their arrangement, because people, you know, have taken note that it's weird that you haven't tested him in so long, that the database is up there. You know, it seems odd. There's people have been tested like 6 times in the time between now and his last test. We heard that story about, it was John Hathaway who was out dealing with health problems, and it was like USADA was still showing up a few times a year. He wasn't fighting at all. They're still showing up to test that guy. And now, especially since Conor McGregor is in the period of recovering from a devastating leg break, which also happens to be the period in which, once Anderson Silva was coming out of basically that same leg break, that's when he got popped for steroids. If you were going to use some steroids to help your progression, this would kind of be that time.
Yeah.
And so to have that going on, the complete lack of any testing showing up in the USADA database, and then, by the way, you keep posting pictures of yourself looking jacked as fuck. It's not helping things, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talked about the transparency in and around this USADA-UFC relationship earlier in the show. But I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could sit here and confidently say, well, it's not that they're just not testing the biggest pay-per-view draw in the history of the company as he recovers from this terrible broken leg, because they're worried he might be on something and they are trying hard not to know. Wouldn't it be great if we could say, I'm sure that's not what they're doing. Like, we can be confident that's not what they're doing. And yet we can't say that. It could well be. The possibility certainly exists that vis-a-vis drug testing Conor McGregor, we are trying hard not to know right now what he is up to.
Yeah. And meanwhile, he's trying hard in various ways to let us know what he's up to, whether we want to know or not.
He is extremely online, continues to be extremely online. And you know how I know he's extremely online? Because the industry is full of reporters who will tell me what Conor McGregor has just tweeted all the time. 100% of the time, someone will Photoshop up a quote card to use on Twitter telling me what Conor McGregor just tweeted. That's how I know what Conor McGregor tweets.
Yeah, well, and also when he might just post a video of himself receiving oral sex on the deck of a yacht, that's, you know, they're going to let you know about that too.
Yeah.
That's going to be out there. I guess, to me, it just seems like I can understand why somebody would want to use steroids in or some other kind of substances to help them recover from such a devastating injury. And I bet there's a bunch of other fighters who'd be in like, I'm dealing with injuries, or I've been dealing with injuries, or I've had them in the past and stuff. I'd love to be able to use it for that purpose. That's one of the things I feel like maybe we have misunderstood at times in this sport. We focus, especially in the, like you said, in the TRT era when Vitor Belfort was showing up with fucking traps coming out of his ears, looking like a goddamn action figure, and then spin kicking people in the head to the point where, like, and as Michael Bisping will still bring up to this day, that he lost an eye that way, then it was very easy to focus on this is affecting what people are able to do to other people physically, and it's dangerous. And I think we focused a lot on that when a lot of fighters would tell you the thing that they wanted was the recovery and recuperative powers that various performance-enhancing substances could give them. Not only to increase their longevity in the sport, but just to be able to get back on the mats, do more, compete more, all that kind of stuff. But it just seems like a guy like Conor McGregor, he's already going to have so many advantages, both in how the UFC treats him, the matchmaking they'll give him. He could just basically ask for any fight at any weight, and the UFC is going to probably make that happen if it's at all possible for them to do it. Got the money to spend on his own private training camp, bring in whoever he wants for it, all that kind of stuff. We're going to give him one more thing by not showing up to drug test him? Like, he didn't already have enough going for him in his favor?
Maybe if you don't want to be tested by USADA, what you should do is opt for the transient lifestyle of the super rich. Have these other fighters thought about that? Like, if you're out on your yacht in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, it's just going to be harder for USADA to test you. Like, you're going to get the USADA guy out there in a little dinghy with like an outboard motor comes steaming up to Conor McGregor's yacht. Or I don't know, you show up in Crumlin knocking on the door. Oh, Conor McGregor? Yeah, he's in Monaco this week at the Formula One race. Like, maybe other fighters should just try this.
Why didn't they think of that?
Yeah, it's weird.
You know, though, that what you're asking for is that for somebody to be like on a carnival cruise for 6 months and then to show up afterwards, like just turning sideways to get out the door of the cabin on their way, getting off the ship, coming back to fight. And you're like, I'm ready.
Right. Looking like a professional chess player.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me? And then we'll move on to round number two. Ben, what is your Are You Fucking Kidding Me this week?
Chad, I'm just going to read you a headline that I saw on Bloody Elbow today by Kevin Bradley. The headline, Megadeth frontman Dave Mustaine earns BJJ brown belt at 61 years old.
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Take that, BJ Penn.
I mean, take that, Tom Hardy, who's still out here sandbagging in the blue belt division of all these tournaments and getting up on the podium. Dave Mustaine is 60 fucking 1 years old. Just got promoted to brown belt. Now, I do wonder a little bit here that it says here, that I'm going to read from the story. 61-year-old guitarist was promoted by Gracie Barr, Spring Hill head coach Reginaldo Almeida, and accompanied by fellow Megadeth guitarist and one-stripe white belt Kiko Loureiro. So first of all, I'm just going to pause and be like, imagine Dave Mustaine is years into his BJJ, gets his guitarist like, come on, man, come on down to the BJJ gym with me, man. Get on the mats. It'll be fun. And then you're just fucking tying him in knots, letting him know Megadeth is still your band.
Yeah.
Don't get any ideas in your head.
Mm-hmm. You'll do exactly as many guitar solos as I tell you to do, Kiki.
And then it says, Almeida was also responsible for promoting Mustaine to purple belt in January of 2021 and to blue belt years prior. I'm just saying, it's a quick promotion.
Yeah, it sounds like he's advancing through the ranks pretty fast there after a long period of... he must have just got serious about it. Must have just dedicated himself to the arts.
You know, I mean, maybe when the pandemic hit, you got more time to spend on the mats. You're not touring or anything like that. Maybe that was part of it. I just want to share this quote that the story wisely ends on that Dave Mustaine wrote on social media in his announcement of the promotion. Quote, behind every mountain is more mountains.
Oh, wow.
Are you fucking kidding me? Now that is some Dave Mustaine shit.
Yeah, that's...
To get promoted to brown belt and then just to hit you with that. Think about it.
Put it on a t-shirt. Wow, that's deep. That is deep right there.
Fucking kidding me?
Well, Ben, the WWE had a quote-unquote fight pit match over the weekend between Seth Rollins and Matt Riddle, former MMA fighter, basically kind of looked like a steel cage match to me, except there was no door in the cage, and there was a platform going around the top of the cage, which made it very convenient for Matt Riddle to jump off of later when that became an opportunity for him. But what I really wanted to talk about here is Daniel Cormier, who we talked about earlier in this round, showing up to be the special guest referee for this match. Are you fucking kidding me? Dreams do come true, my guy. Daniel Cormier, this is like a lifelong dream, has to be, for DC to show up and referee a match in the WWE. And I hope you don't think for one goddamn second that Daniel Cormier is not going to pull on the striped shirt. The black and white striped shirt, tuck it into a pair of tight black polyester pants and roll out there with the black, like, Keds or whatever they are. You know, black pair of sneakers that he bought at the discount shoe store before this. Because you would be wrong. If you invite Daniel Cormier to your professional wrestling event to be the referee, he's going to dress like the fucking referee.
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me? There's nothing about this I don't love.
Tell me, did he do the thing where he goes up to each wrestler beforehand and has them like put their arms out the sides and like checks their, like all the way down their knee pads to their boots, check for foreign objects? Do we do that?
Checking for foreign substances. Make sure you don't have any oil in the hair that you could use to blind your opponent.
Did he do the gesturing at sometimes where he has to get in between there and like motion, like you got to stop grabbing the hair. I see you doing that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, shaking his finger.
If I had to guess, not watching the pay-per-view myself, Daniel Cormier took things very seriously, if I had to guess.
Really in control of the match is what you're saying.
You fucking kidding me? That's awesome.
Fucking kidding me?
That's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Well, Chad, Alistair Overeem went out there and did the damn thing at Glory Collision 4. He's back in the world of kickboxing, back in there mixing it up with his old pal Badr Hari. And, you know, even though it seemed like maybe things were going the other way, Alistair Overeem held on to win the thing. And I gotta say, you look at some clips from this fight, Alistair Overeem is still a beefy boy.
Yeah.
Can still throw them thangs. And also, it seems like, this is the part that is somehow craziest to me. After all these years, Alistair Overeem still seems to legitimately enjoy this shit. Some fighters, you know, you've seen them, for one thing, like, so a lot of them start out enjoying this shit. A lot of them are just trying to do it for the money, make and tell you that they want to make their money and get out. Some of them, the enjoyment of this shit gets sort of slowly ground out of them over the years. Alistair Overeem still seems like he sees the inevitable time when he'll have to stop fighting in every combat sport altogether as a really sad thing that he doesn't want to face.
Yeah.
I'm kind of amazed by that.
I agree, man. 42 years old, hasn't fought in a kickboxing match since December of 2010. Now he's going to go out here, climb right back in with Badr Hari and get the win via unanimous decision after what I understand was an exciting third round. Kind of doing, frankly, the KG veteran version of Alistair Overeem that we saw during the latter stages of his UFC career. And I'll be honest, I struggle to think of a fighter that I personally have had more and differing opinions on than Alistair Overeem throughout his career. Because he starts out as this like beanpole light heavyweight over there in Pride. When you look at the guy and you think, I don't know, he seems okay, but he doesn't seem like he's going to set the world on fire. He ain't
carrying
no
the big
Shogun.
Ass wooden hammer though, carrying that hammer down to the ring.
Thinking that the hammer is pretty awesome, but like he ain't no Vanderlei. He ain't no Shogun. You're thinking watching these fights. And then all of a sudden, he wins the Strikeforce heavyweight championship and decides he's going to peace out to Japan for years on end and transform himself into one of the most physically imposing specimens we have ever seen in this sport. Like we talked at length about the TRT era earlier in this show. Ain't nobody took advantage of that with maybe the exception of Vitor Belfort, like Alistair Overeem, because the Uber-ream, much like Barry Bonds, was one of the more impressive figures you could see in this sport at the height of his power. And I'll be honest, at that point, I was not a huge Overeem fan.
Yeah.
And then the USADA era comes in and Overeem transforms himself yet again into a less physically imposing heavyweight version of himself, but still one that will go out there and kind of win these fights through moxie and savvy and his veteran wiles. And yes. I found myself thinking, God damn, I like Alistair Overeem now. I'm cheering for Alistair Overeem. And so when I see him go out here, go back to glory. Another thing that I have grown to appreciate about Alistair Overeem is he will always do the thing that will pay him the most money with zero exceptions. He will always take the money and go do that thing, which I say, good for you, Alistair. But to see him coming out here now, going back to kickboxing, getting in a scrap with his old nemesis, Badr Hari, winning the rubber match between those guys, and then getting in the cage and getting into it with Rico Verhoeven, I think you go, Alistair. I want to see him ride this train as long as he can, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that he has lived many different lives, and I've covering them as a reporter and watching him as a fan have felt many different ways about it. And yet it also, maybe it's easier to feel like you can put it in context now, because it does feel sometimes when you look back at some of these guys where you go, well, okay, he was definitely on some gear and bulked way the hell up, but he was also doing it at a time when maybe he looked around and felt like that's what everybody else was doing. And, you know, not that that forgives it necessarily, but it does put it under a different light in some way. It also, though, I remember it very well when he was nominally the Strikeforce heavyweight champion, but had peaced out to Japan and wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
And anybody who wanted to fight him had to go over there to Japan to fight him. And everybody was looking at him being like, bro, you are inhabiting a completely different body. Like, you are basically like in the first Iron Man movie when Jeff Bridges gets in his giant-ass Iron Man suit. And you look like you are wearing an Alistair Overeem suit right now. and we kind of can tell what's going on, and we can do the math on why you don't want to leave Japan and come back to the U.S. and fight. And I remember at the time you'd ask Scott Coker about it, when we'd be like, okay, so is Alistair still your heavyweight champion? He'd be like, yeah, of course. And he'd be like, is he going to fight in the U.S.? And he'd be like, oh, yeah, sure, he'll fight in the U.S. I don't know what you guys are talking about. He'll fight when we have a fight for him. And it's like, okay, you're acting like we can't all see what's going on and do the math here. But then you're right. Like, when you watched him continue on in the UFC, when he was, you know, after he had been popped with a positive test, and then when the drug testing environment got more stringent. And remember, there was, even before he actually got popped, there was that incident of him running out on the Nevada commission when they were trying to test him prior to one of the bouts. I remember Dana White telling the story about after, you know, he brought Alistair in, but then after Alistair popped positive and he went through this whole sort of, now, which seems very performative, like, anger at Alistair, because he was like, hey, that guy told me he wasn't on anything, we didn't have to worry about anything, and then he failed a drug test. And he said Alistair came to the office, the Zuffa offices in Las Vegas, and sat there in the lobby for hours until Dana White would meet with him so that he could talk to him face to face and sort of smooth it out. And then was afterwards like, oh, I got a lot more respect for the guy after kind of doing that stuff. But then when he continued on, I remember him showing back up after some of those, and you'd be like, okay, you clearly have a different body now, bro. That tells us something, doesn't it? And we thought, well, that will be the end of Alistair Overeem. And then it wasn't. Like, he wasn't a dominating figure anymore, but, like, he also was just aging, and but he was hanging on at heavyweight and still beating some good guys and was still a dangerous guy who, frankly, at that point, could do a lot more than he could back in his prime when he was just a big-ass kickboxer.
Yeah. I may have said earlier that he won the Bellator heavyweight championship. Of course, I meant Strikeforce heavyweight championship. I agree with all of that about Alistair Overeem. And, like, well, if anything was like a poster boy for the effectiveness of getting on the gear and then the perils of getting off.
Yeah.
Because the version of Alistair Overeem who showed up in the UFC and kicked Brock Lesnar in his surgically repaired stomach was not the one who finished out his career. And I say, you know, like, you, I would just echo what you said. More power to him at the end there for utilizing his career savvy. I don't know what the testing is like over there in Glory, but I'm not going to ask too many questions about that.
I mean, the other favorite Alistair Overeem memory I have is when I went to cover the Dynamite New Year's Eve show in like 2009, and that was one where that was Overeem. And I believe he knocked out Fujita there, kneed him in the head super hard, and Fujita was out for a while. And that was one where it was like, maybe we shouldn't be doing this exactly. Maybe there are some perils to having a guy get a little bit enhanced and becoming a giant and then kneeing people in the head. But he showed up afterwards to be interviewed by the media, and I remember asking him, like, okay, what's your plans now? Like, he'd been fighting either in the Netherlands or Japan and not doing anything, like, kind of in the U.S. And I was like, are you going to go back, defend the Strikeforce title? What are you going to do? And he laid out his plan for 2010, where he was like, I'm going to win the K1 Grand Prix, and I'm going to fight Fedor. And I was like, are these, actual firm plans? Have you had a commitment that you will get the Fedor fight? Like, or are you just spitballing some wishes at this point? And he kind of like looked at me like I was annoying him. And then he said, first K1 Grand Prix, then Fedor. And then you know what he did? He went out there and he won the K1 Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Did not get that Fedor fight, however.
Yeah. My memory of Alistair Overeem is when I went to one of the pre-fight press conferences that they did for UFC 141 before he fought Brock Lesnar. This was like a couple months before it. You know how they would do those kind of like pump up press conferences to like announce the fight almost. And they had the poster that was all about how big both dudes were.
Yeah.
Like
It was a beefy boy slapping meat poster. We just didn't know it at the time.
The pre-fight run-up for UFC 141 was basically just about all how huge both these guys were. And I remember they brought Brock out on the stage first, and he was wearing like his, you know, stonewashed looking Death Clutch t-shirt or button-up, whatever it was, the one dress shirt in Brock Lesnar's collection. And I was like, oh, that's, look at this huge guy. And then they brought Alistair Overeem out, and I was like, this guy is going to kill Brock Lesnar. He is the biggest person that I've ever seen in my life. And then they did like a media scrum off the stage with Alistair Overeem. Like, Alistair Overeem's wearing a suit and tie, of course, because he's not going to look like a fucking jerk at the press conference. And I went up and I stood next to Alistair over him, and it was just like he was one of the most physically impressive human beings that I've ever seen in my life. He was just fucking enormous. There's no other way to say it.
Well, I remember being at that fight when he fought Lesnar, and he came in first. Lesnar entered second, and Overeem just went and stood in the center of the cage and watched Brock Lesnar throughout his entire entrance, watched him get in the cage and jog around. And then I remember Overeem just turned to his corner and looked at his brother who was standing there in his corner, and then just gave his brother a nod like, okay, we got it.
Yeah.
And then he did.
Yeah, kicked him right in his stomach. All right, that's going to do it for round number two. We will be right back with round number three. Well, Ben, it's hard to even know what to say about this UFC Fight Night, UFC Fight Night 212, UFC on ESPN plus 70 that goes down on Saturday at the UFC Apex Arena in Las Vegas, Nevada. Alexa Grasso and Viviane Araujo, your women's flyweight main event here. Only four fights, scheduled for the main card, according to Wikipedia. We'll have to see if that holds up to the actual broadcast schedule when this thing goes down. But your co-main event, Cub Swanson versus Jonathan Martinez, Brandon Royval versus Oscar Oskarov, and then it goes from there. But this, again, like I said at the top of the show, this is the kind of event that really underscores what a lackluster October we're working on here, because this just kind of feels like one where we scraped together whoever was available, and we're putting this on a couple weeks before UFC 280, hoping nobody gets burned out on the product before we have to ask them to pay for UFC 280. This is just, you know, we talked about Mackenzie Dern and Shonan Yan a week or two ago being a very low budget or low wattage, very low profile UFC fight night that eventually we did for the pleasure of just one billionaire. This is kind of the same thing, man. Like, if you got something else to do on Saturday night, I will not sit here and try to convince you to stay home to watch Alexa Grasso versus Viviane Araujo.
Will you convince me to try to stay home and watch Cubby Sampson?
You know, we all love Cubby Sampson. We want to watch him fight every time he fights. But again, it's just sort of like this is just another very random feeling UFC fight night that's going down amid a stretch of very random UFC fight nights. I mean, I guess, you know, you remember when Alexa Grasso came over from Invicta, where she was 8-0 at the time. You know, 6 years ago now, she came over and made her UFC debut. And she was really, there was a lot of hype behind her at the time. We thought that she might be one of the next great fighters in these women's divisions. And it just didn't happen for her right away when she came into the UFC. She's had 3 losses since then. But lo and behold, you look at where she's at now. Still just 29 years old, which is kind of amazing. Not even 30 years old. She's won 3 fights in a row. She beat Macy Barber, and she beat the Whispering Warrior, Joanne Wood. So maybe at this point, Alexa Grasso is starting to put it together a little bit, and maybe still intends on making good on that potential that we thought she had when she came in 2016.
Yeah, and you know what? I definitely think that if it turns out that we look back and be like, okay, maybe we all decided that Alexa Grasso wasn't as good as we hoped too early, just sort of chronologically and where she was in her career, I would absolutely be able to buy that. And she comes in here as a pretty sizable favorite to win this fight. You're right, though, that it does seem like this feels like one of those events where we're just somebody got to go last. We don't necessarily have a main event. Somebody's just got to go last. This is exactly the kind of main event, really, that you were talking about when you argued that we don't need them all to be 5 rounds, necessarily. Yeah. You know? But, I don't, you know, this seems like the kind of fight night card where it was made for me to circle back on Sunday morning with it. Because there's some stuff, like, there's some interesting stuff on here. Like, you know, anytime Cubby Sampson fights, I'm going to want to see that. Cub Swanson versus TBA, sure. I will watch that. Also, though, Brandon Royval and Askar Askarov, like, that's pretty good. You know, even the Misha Sirkunov and Alonzo Menafield, like, sure, I'll watch some of this stuff. And yet, for me, the question always comes, do I want to watch it so bad to sit through all the filler content that you have to sit through if you want to watch it live? Like, I don't feel like it'd be so difficult for me to live my life and avoid spoilers, and therefore then get on there and watch it Sunday morning. Even if I do catch some spoilers, might not necessarily ruin my time. I can still enjoy a cup of coffee, maybe a donut, some nice colored sprinkles on it, sit down and find out what happened to Cubby Sampson. Like, that's totally fine. It does feel like sort of placeholder content. But if the flip side of that is that we're doing this on these fight nights so that the pay-per-views get a little more loaded up, I won't complain, because those are the ones that feel like they're worth watching live.
Yeah. Alexa Grasso currently going off at -205 in the DraftKings sportsbook as compared to +175 for the 35-year-old Viviana Araujo. So those are your main event betting lines for that one. I mean, I always want to watch Cub Swanson because we don't know how many more of these fights we're going to get. He comes in 3-1 in his last four. He just beat Darren Elkins in December of 2021 via first round stoppage. So he's certainly not done going out there against, again, the 28-year-old Jonathan Martinez, who has also won three in a row. So I don't know if we're angling for the same kind of Frankie Edgar kind of matchmaking here, but maybe Cub Swanson and Jonathan Martinez can be a little bit more competitive than what we expect that one to be. Let me see if I can get the odds on my screen here for
Cub Swanson.
Yeah.
I believe he's going off at about +160 as the underdog here.
Okay.
Jonathan Martinez close to a 2-1 favorite.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. I mean, you're right that maybe we're saving it for October the 22nd when we get into UFC 280 over there in Abu Dhabi. And frankly, that's kind of okay. And this is, we talked about this earlier in the year, that perhaps the UFC had settled on this programming strategy, I guess you would say, to really stack these pay-per-view events, make sure that as many people as possible buy them, that they feel like events, kind of at the expense of some of the fight nights. So maybe that's what we're seeing play out here, which is say okay with me, really, since I'll be in my seat for UFC 280 for sure. And this is probably one that I can watch the breakout videos of on Sunday.
Well, but you know, also because they got a pay-per-view coming up to sell, you know, you're going to, if you do watch it live to where you have to sit through all the stuff in this fight night, you're going to see a lot of ads for UFC 280, a lot of talk to promote it, which, you know, listen, just, you could go ahead and tell the UFC now, anybody who is sitting through that fight night, they're already enough of a fan that they know about UFC 280.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. Someone might be on there to watch their, ESPN Plus. What's the name of the sport that I was saying? It's like volleyball, but they kick the thing over a ping pong ball table. Tech ball, something like that. Maybe you showed up to watch your tech ball. You stumbled upon this UFC fight night. And the next thing you know, you're using your billions to rent out the Apex to go watch Alexa Grasso fight. I don't know how these things work.
You know what? I think some of us would use our billions differently. That's all.
All right, let's do Just Saying Stuff, and then we'll get out of here for this week. Ben, I saw this headline, Alexander K. Lee over there at MMA Fighting. Frank Mir wants a retirement fight on the same card, headlined by his daughter, Bella. Of course, Bella Mir has been making her way as an MMA fighter over the last couple years. Comes from good stock, you might say. And here's Frank Mir talking on the, what podcast is he on here? Fight Night Flashbacks podcast. Okay. One of my favorites, definitely in the heavy rotation. He says, next year I'm going to go and fight again because I actually want to fight once on the same card with Bella as my last fight, Mir said. She can headline the card and I can open it. So I guess this week I'm just saying, that's nice. I mean, that's just, it's not a lot of, you don't get a lot of nice stories in this sport. I feel like this is just nice. As a father myself, the fact that Frank Mir wants to come fight on the same card as his daughter, open it up for her, it's nice. It's just nice. It's heartwarming. It's as heartwarming as a bunch of people about to have cage fights can get.
You know what I think the most heartwarming part is that he's talking about he wants to be the curtain jerker and she can be the main event.
Hell yeah.
Spotlighting her.
As we would all do for our children.
Well, I would try to keep my children out of professional fighting just based on what I have learned about it over the course of my career. But you know what? Maybe we all took different lessons from our life, the roads that we have gone down.
I think it's nice. I'm just saying.
It is nice. Well, Chad, I'm just saying. I don't know if you saw Michael Bisping's comments about Mark Zuckerberg being the basically sole audience member at this fight night recently. But he was a fan of it. He said it was pretty cool to see. Here's a quote, though, from him, from his podcast, Believe You Me, where he's talking about, you know, people, you know, who had some thoughts about how a rich, powerful guy just comes in and what that does for the optics there. He says they're all good points, and this isn't meant as an insult to him, and it sounds like a meathead comment, but... And he's implying here more fans can get into the sport because of someone that's as nerdy as him. He's a tech genius. You've seen him. And he can be described as, quote unquote, a bit of a nerd. But to see a guy like him who does have that influence, who does have that wealth, who does have that power, and I don't know what to think about Mark Zuckerberg. He's a fucking nerd, let's be honest. But he's awesome because he's there and he's watching the UFC. I believe this will open up potentially another realm of people because MMA is hugely and wildly popular, but there's still skeptics, there's critics, and there's people that won't give it a shot. But seeing someone that's clearly wildly intelligent as he is to be an admirer of the sport, and his wife is there enjoying it, it's only going to bring in more fans. So I guess, Chad, this week I'm just saying, does Michael Bisping, is he under the impression that fucking nerds are not already watching MMA? Because my man, they are. The fan base is filled with fucking nerds. We knew that. We've known that for a long time. Nerds love MMA, man.
Yeah, that's true.
It's the kind of fandom that you can get really nerdy about. And sometimes those nerds are also people who are super into, like, martial arts and do it, practice it themselves. Sometimes they don't. They're just really into talking about it. But my brother, the nerds are already here. The nerd call is coming from inside the house. Fucking nerds are already watching the UFC, watching MMA in droves. I know because we hear from them regularly on this podcast.
Oh, that's how you know?
That's how we know. Honestly, the extent to which we all get super into this sport and spend all our time talking about it and thinking about everything, maybe we're all fucking nerds. We're just nerds for MMA. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I was going to say saying. You know because you are one. Just saying. Yeah. I know because I frequently hear from these nerds.
I
Ben Fox,
an awesome, cool guy, sometimes hear from nerds, believe it or not. I talk to one via this podcast kind of regularly.
Some of my best friends are nerds, says Ben
Fox. I mean, right. Imagine looking around and being like, maybe Mark Zuckerberg will bring in some nerds. Bro, you're surrounded by nerds.
That's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event Podcast. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. Of course, we are over at the Patreon page all week. Wednesday live chats. We're going to try to do exclusively questions from new patrons this Wednesday on the live chat. So you could get in, ask a question. Thursday, we got doing the damn thing. Friday, the power hour. You can join at any one of our handy patronage tiers. Check us out over there, patreon.com/co-main event, if you would. If you happen to be a $20 patron of the Co-Main Event already, stick around after the show for Co-Main Event Podcast After Hours. For the rest of you, thanks for listening. We are done. We are through. We are out. I tell you what, this UFC 280 kind of can't get here fast enough as far as I'm concerned. I think you might have been onto something earlier when you were like, maybe they made this October fight schedule sucks so bad, so we would all be excited for UFC 280, because that's how I feel about it. We're going to have this fight night this weekend, Alexa Grasso and Viviana Araujo, and I'm already looking at the card of UFC 280 with Chucky Olives and Islam Makhachev, Aljamain Sterling and TJ Dillashaw, Peter Yan and Sean O'Malley, Beneil Dariush on this thing, you know, Bilal Muhammad and Sean Brady, Nikita Krylov and the Secret of the U's. I'm looking at this whole thing and I'm just saying, give it to me, it's mine, man. We can't get to October 22nd fast enough.
Yeah, there's there's a lot to look forward here, and especially when the more starved we feel for content that matters for big time fights, the more it's going to feel like a welcome relief once we finally get it.
I've been noticing on social media that the fighters are all already starting to show up in Abu Dhabi, which makes me feel like maybe we've learned a little bit since we started doing these things, that we're a couple weeks out and...